Thank you all for coming. So indeed, I'll be talking about topological phases and their transitions in 1D. So that's work I've been doing with my supervisor, Frank Pohlmann, and then also Roderick Musner. So the classification of these topological phases has already been well understood since 2010, basically simultaneously by three groups. So there was Witkowski and Kitayev. Then there was Turner, Pohlmann, and Berg. And then also Si Chen, Gu, and Wen. So that was all in 2010. Okay, so that's all well understood and done. So I'm going to be talking about something else today. I have two aims in my talk. Firstly, I'll try to illustrate how many of the known models of these topological phases in 1D are actually related to each other. So I'll discuss some relationships between these known models. And in particular, by making these relations explicit, it turns out that we can get some new insights. Okay, and then the second part of the talk, I'll be addressing a different question. Basically, I'm posing myself the following question. If I have two topological phases, is there a generic expectation of their phase transitions? So by just knowing the phases, can I predict their transitions, right? Basically, is it first order, second order, what universality class? Okay, good. So first I'll give a short review of these topological phases in 1D. So what do I mean by these topological phases, and how do we understand them since those works in 2010? Okay, so the so a short recap of, and they're called SPTs. So it stands for symmetry protected topological phases. And in case the name is not familiar to you, you'll soon understand why it's called this. Okay, so the setup is the following. So take some one-dimensional chain, right? And suppose it's, so take a chain, and suppose it has some symmetry, but let's suppose the symmetry is not spontaneously broken. With an unbroken symmetry U. Okay, so then there's a following claim. I say then, actually, if you take a ground state and you act the symmetry operator on it, in the bulk, nothing changes. So effectively, the symmetry operator in the bulk looks like the identity. Okay, generically on the edges, things can happen, so which I call generically by the name U subscript L, and here U subscript R. So I'm saying effectively, any symmetry acts like this in the ground state subspace. So why do I say this? So in case you're not familiar with these ideas, you might first wonder, well, if I'm saying we have an unbroken symmetry, doesn't that by definition mean that the ground state should be invariant? So how can something change at all? Well, an unbroken symmetry doesn't actually mean the ground state has to be invariant. What it actually means is the following. Suppose we have our Hilbert space, and we have our original state psi. And then suppose we act our U on it, and suppose we end up far away in Hilbert space, so that this region is macroscopically distinct from this region. Think, for example, of the Ising model where we have all spins up, we do spin flips and get all spins down. And that's a case where you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, because now the symmetry relates to macroscopically distinct states, which cannot talk to each other with the local fluctuations, and so the ground state will spontaneously break into one of the two sectors. But that's all you can exclude. If I say there's no unbroken symmetry, still there's nothing preventing me that the symmetry can change the ground state a bit, just not in an extensive way. So that's why I can basically argue that in the bulk nothing is changing, because in the bulk the system is approximately translation invariant, say, and so suppose the symmetry would affect this region, by translation invariance it would also affect this region, and this region, and this region, so effectively it would alter the whole bulk, and now we would have macroscopically distinct states, and the system would have spontaneous symmetry breaking, in contradiction with our assumption. So that's how you justify this general decomposition of a symmetry operator. So more shorthand notation, I will write it like this, where the symmetry splits up in these two operators. Because of the splitting up, sometimes referred to as symmetry fractionalization. So I'm not sure if fractionalization is a real English word, but it describes what's going on, so I'm going to use it.
So you know the definition of how the GH is the state. If you have upper plus or down, you call it symmetric frequency, you call it the symmetric
So it's more so the GAZ state, and you're asking whether...
For example, for the IC model, if you have a state with up, plus, down. So that state is invariant on the IC symmetry action.
Yeah, that's true, but I'm talking about... so that would... A physical system would spontaneously break into one of those two sectors, right? Because some environment would locally connect to either spin up or spin down, and the system would decohere. And so the physical states are all ups or all downs. So I'm...
Not necessarily. It can be superposition. Can be up, down.
Right, but that would not be a physically stable state, right? So I'm focusing on... I'm assuming that whatever Grandstam is discussing is like... is not a artificial superposition, but it's actually what you would see in a physical system.
It can be, because if your oil perturbation preserves the symmetry. In your case, you suppose you have a small...
Like, right, but it's a generic expectation that something in the environment is likely to at least perturb it locally.
That means the environment perturbation already breaks this.
Yeah, but it's... I agree what you're saying, but still, effectively, that's why we talk about symmetry breaking, because we know in any reasonable... Like, you can never exclude that anything in the universe will somehow have some coupling that will break the symmetry.
Usually, we define symmetry as spontaneous symmetry breaking by using this so-called order parameter or Langevin order, right? So you compute this correlation function, and if it contains Langevin correlation, then it does not matter if you use this... GHZ state, or using this
state. Okay, sure. You can equivalently say, let's presume I focus on short range and angle states, and then this argument applies. Then I am looking at these ups, all ups or all downs, and not kind of these long ranged entangled states. But okay, maybe we can talk more about later instead of. Okay, and so once you know you have this formula, actually you get. From this formula, you can derive the whole idea of this classification of 1D systems. Because let's see what some consequences are. Well, firstly, so these two operators act on disjoint regions, right? They act on the left and the right. More exactly, the scale is given by the correlation length, typically. So you see that if we have a system with a finite correlation length, so a gap system, then if you take a thermodynamic limit, it'll always become exact that this region has no overlap with this region. Okay. So, and if that's true, then you can imagine simply arguing that if this guy has to be a symmetry, has to commute as Hamiltonian, well, this vector has to commute, but now they're on disjoint regions, and then actually you can simply argue they separately have to commute to the Hamiltonian. So now we have two symmetries of the Hamiltonian. So we started with one, now we have two. And then the next piece of information is that, okay, so I was talking about this generic symmetry U. Of course, you can have another symmetry. And as we know, in general, symmetries have group relations between them. And so this will enforce a certain group relation between these fractionalized symmetries on the boundary. For example, suppose that U and V commuted, and suppose U squared is 1. Then it's a very simple argument, two lines, to show that the fractionalized symmetries commute up to a sign. It's not that hard to show. And so now note that we now have a discrete invariant. Because as soon as you get a minus 1, even if you now perturb the Hamiltonian, this minus 1 can never become a plus 1, right? Because of continuous change cannot change just a sign. So that's what we call a topological invariant. That's why we call these topological phases in this point of, in this kind of framework. And note, the presence of anti-commuting symmetries means we have degeneracies. Right? Linear algebra tells us two operators that anti-commute must have a degeneracy if they're both symmetries of the Hamiltonian. Good. So in particular, this shows that the degeneracies live on the edge because these only act on the edge. So now we know there's the degeneracies living on the edge. We call them edge modes. And so more generally, if U, V, etc. are a representation of some group G, you can argue that U subscript L, P subscript L, etc. are a projective representation of G, which means exactly this, that their group relations hold up to some of these phase factors. And so then the conclusion is that
for this projective representation, it means that there's fixed back in the associativity relation, not in the commutative relation. Suppose.
Well, yeah, but you can basically choosing a certain gauge in your projective representation, you can give a concrete place to where this happens. And in this case, you can choose it to be here in a. You can, if you make a certain gauge choice for UL and VL, then you can get, for example, this kind of group relation. We'll see a specific example in a moment, actually. And so the conclusion here is that for any, so if the correlation length is finite, that was an important part, right? So if we have a gapped phase of matter, then any symmetry induces a projective representation on the edge, on both edges. And in particular, if this projective representation is non-trivial, like in that case where there would be anti-commutation, so if this is non-trivial, then we have some non-trivial facts about our system, namely that there's a degeneracy, and then we say the symmetry protects our phase, or protects the edge mode, however you want to say it. And that's where the name SPT comes from, symmetry protected topological phase, right? Because as long as you keep the symmetry, this kind of analysis stays well-defined, and these edge modes stay well-defined. So let me give a simple example. So even those who are maybe quite familiar with SPTs might not know the following model. Well, it's only like 10 years old. It's the cluster state, the cluster model. And it's just a simple spin a half chain. And Hamiltonian is simply a three spin interaction, sigma x, sigma z, so sigma x. So it's not the most physical looking interaction, but it's very convenient, as we'll soon see. And it's interesting for various reasons. So let me first write down Hamiltonian, or generally. So I should use a shorthand notation now, where I don't explicitly write out the Pauli spin operators, but just write the capital letters to denote the spin operators. I put a minus sign there. So this was first written down in 2000 by Briegel and Hausendorff for their interest in measurement-based quantum computing, which I won't go into here. And then I think about 10 years later, so 2011, it was realized that it's actually a topological phase. So there was work by Son, Hama, et al. Okay, so if I'm saying this is a symmetry-protected topological phase, we're going to have to be talking about a certain symmetry. So let's see what kind of symmetries this model has. Well, we can, if we apply a sigma z operator on every odd site, you can see that this commutes with every term in the Hamiltonian. So it's indeed a symmetry. And then similarly, we can do it on every even site. So there's two symmetries. They both commute. They both square to 1. So they form this Z2 cross Z2 group structure. OK, and now the claim is, like any symmetry, like the previous argument was true for any symmetry, they fractionalize onto the edges. And on the edges, these guys, P1 and P2, on the edges, anti-commute. And this then shows we have a topological phase. And it's really nice that this argument is really simple. So this simple argument I'm going to tell now is, I read it first in Wen's book, but I don't know if that's the original place. So the proof is two lines, basically. If you look at the Hamiltonian there, all the terms commute with each other, and they square to 1. So if an operator squares to 1, the eigenvalues are plus 1 or minus 1. And since they all commute, they can all take classical numbers. And because of the global minus sign in the ground state, all of these terms are 1. So in the ground state subspace, we have that xn minus 1, zn xn plus 1 equals 1. And now this is a really simple relationship, which we can start multiplying. Right, 1 equals 1 times 1 times 1. And now we can start using Pauli algebras. x3 squared is 1, x5 squared is 1. And the things that remain is x1, z2, z4, z6, cn minus 2, x, assuming an even number of sites. But now we see something we saw before. If you look back at the definition of P2, it's exactly sigma z on the even sites. So that's P2. I'm missing the last sigma z. In other words, bringing P2 on one side, we've shown that P2 effectively in the ground state subspace acts like this. Right? So even the definition of P2 is a very global operator, it's doing something everywhere. Effectively, using ground state subspace knowledge, we can reduce it to something acting only on the left. So this defines P2L, this defines P2R. Right? So this guy here, and then analogously, there's an argument showing P1L is this guy. And now we just see on site, okay, X1 anti-commutes with C1. So we're done. Right? And so in this very particular limit, we can exactly calculate these things. But the point is that any perturbations cannot change this anti-commutation sign. And so we have this well-defined edge mode all over the phase. And so that's a nice example, and very, very good example of spin chains in general. Whenever you have a topological phase of spin chains, it's always something like this, where you have some symmetry that's acting on the physical space, and there's some kind of projective representation on the edge that protects the edge modes. So that's all that can happen in for spin chains. You can have different symmetries, but always kind of these projective representations. There's one other. Was there something? Yeah. Yeah, sure.
How do you come from these projective symmetries to the edge modes?
Oh, so okay, so we have now well-defined symmetries. So because these P1L and P2L themselves are symmetries, right? Because you can see that they commute to Hamiltonian, but it's also true from general arguments. So now we have two symmetries, and they only act on the left, right? They have only bases on the left, the first two sites. And so we have two anti-commuting symmetries. And if you have two anti-commuting symmetries in general, right, like suppose you have two symmetries A and B, they both can commute with Hamiltonian. And if they anti-commute, you can prove that there's a degeneracy of the ground state. You can show there's not a unique ground state, because the idea is a unique ground state would satisfy the property that these are both just numbers acting on the ground state, but then they would commute. You would have a contradiction. So that's how projective representations always imply a degeneracy. OK, I'll just leave this here. OK. So then one last example, and it's not just an arbitrary example, because it'll be very important for the other stuff I'll be saying, is a fermionic topological phase. And you might have heard of the Kitaev chain. So the definition is also really simple. And now it's a fermionic system, and it's just a one-dimensional wire of fermions, hopping fermions, now with superconducting terms. Okay, so pictorially, here we have our fermionic sites. And we can understand this much better, as Kitaev realized, by going to the Majorana representation. So we can define some Majorana modes. Majorana operators, which are just simply the real and the imaginary part of a fermionic operator. Right? So if you write down the real part, we call that gamma. If you write down the imaginary part, we call that gamma tilde. And note that these are Hermitian operators. They're called Majorana operators. And then using this notation, the Hamiltonian becomes really simple. So it's just this very simple Hamiltonian. And let's do it more visually. So the same is for any fermionic mode, we have two Majorana modes. So let's, we have gamma and gamma tilde, gamma and gamma tilde. Okay, and this Hamiltonian is basically saying, well, couple the gamma tilde of this side to the gamma of the other side. And now you see on sight, there's two Majorana modes that don't enter the Hamiltonian at all. Right, there's this guy, and there's this guy, which is gamma tilde. So there's two Majorana zero modes, Majorana zero mode on every edge. So together they define one non-local fermionic zero mode that's kind of spread out over both edges. I know this system is interesting for quantum computation purposes, as Kitai have discussed in his paper. But so for our purposes, we're interested in these zero edge Majorana zero modes. And well, in this exactly solvable point, we see they're there. But the question is, okay, why are they stable? There's some symmetry protecting them. Also the symmetry. And you can argue you don't even need to protect the symmetry because you cannot break the symmetry even if you wanted. It's fermionic parity symmetry. It just counts whether you have an even or an odd number of fermions in your system. And by generic arguments, again, this fractionalizes. And by doing the exact same analysis, the cluster state, you know that in the ground state, all of these has to be minus one now. And you can simplify this formula, et cetera, et cetera. And you get a simple result. One of the, you can exactly calculate the symmetry fractionalization. Okay, so there's just these Majorana modes. But the important part is, look, they're both fermionic, which means that PL and PR, despite being on disjoint regions, anti-commute. So you see this can never happen for spin chains because it uses the fermionic relations. And now we have our two anti-commuting symmetries which protect the edge mode, no matter what perturbation we add. Unless there's, of course, a phase transition, right? Because we have to presume finite correlation length. Okay. So those two examples together kind of capture all the possibilities you can have. Good. So now I can get on to the first point I want to discuss. I want to show you some relationships between SPTs. And so we'll see actually both of these cluster state and the Kitaev chain will come back. And they turn out to be closely related, actually. So topic one. Relations between SPTs. Good. So let me first make a claim zero because actually anyone who's ever looked at the Kitaev chain knows the following result, which is that the Kitaev chain is so-called Jordan-Wigner dual to the quantum Ising chain. But I want to mention it because it fits into the story. And also to remind you what Jordan-Wigner is again. So in 1D, we have this mapping that relates 1D chains, fermionic chains to spin chains, and vice versa. And it's a really simple relationship. So we can write it down in terms of the Majorana modes we just defined. And then the Majorana mode on side N just corresponds to a string of spin operators, like this. And similarly, we have this. And it turns out then this map spins to fermions with the correct commutation relations. So, but you see it's quite a non-local transformation. So although it respects the energy, it preserves the energies, it can really change the physics because you're doing some non-local thing here. Good. And then it's really easy to see why this claim is true. So we had our simple Kitaev chain here. Now we just plug this in. Many of these Zs cancel, except for one, because they're on two different sites. So we just get this. And then using the Pauli algebra, we get the familiar Kitaev chain. So it's really easy to see. But the interesting thing to note is that this is a quite well-known relationship. And it's interesting that it kind of maps a topological phase to a symmetry-broken phase, kind of showing that Jordan-Wigner does some non-trivial stuff to your physics. OK. Good. But now we'll see actually that this relationship carries on to a more interesting statement. Well, no, not that it's not interesting, but this is very well known, I mean. For that, let's first have a small intermezzo, where I want to either tell or remind you one of the most interesting facts, I think, about symmetry-projected topological phases in any dimension, is the following fact, that if we look at the set of all topological phases, right, so we have a trivial phase, we have some SPT, we have another SPT, et cetera. Let's look at all topological phases with respect to a certain symmetry group G, right? Because we can have a certain physical symmetry, but there's going to be many different ways that they can fractionalize onto the edge and define different SPTs. And we can look at this set. And this set itself is itself a group. Meaning we can add these things together and get new things within the group. So you can add phases. But actually, physically, it's really simple to see. If you just have a wire, so this is general any dimension, but I'm saying in 1D. So suppose SPT1, SPT2, characterized by certain symmetry fractionalizations. If they're both symmetry fractionalizations of the same symmetry, then it actually makes sense to kind of stack them on top of each other, and they then define a new fractionalization onto the edge. And now you again have an SPT in a quasi-1D system. Right. And actually, this kind of property was also really important to figure out in 2010, the general classification of topological phases. People basically looked at the Kitaev chain and started stacking them and seeing what kind of phases you can get. And that was like a really good model to figure things out. So in particular, as an example, they found out that if you look at the set of all fermionic SPTs, protected by either fermionic parity symmetry, like the Kitaev chain, or time reversal symmetry. That reminds me that one thing I wanted to note here is that, okay, so we have fermionic parity symmetry, which protects the state, but maybe I'll write it in green if I can. Oh yeah, it fell here. Note. If we define complex conjugation, time reversal symmetry for spinless fermions, we see that the Hamiltonian is also invariant here. There's no imaginary coefficients. So that's also a symmetry. And so for the Kitaev chain, that's not important because it doesn't protect anything, but it's important, as we'll soon see. So because that means that the Kitaev chain belongs to this set, because it has both symmetries. So there's a trivial phase in there, there's a Kitaev chain, roll up. Turns out there's 8 phases in there, and together they form the group Z8. So it turns out the Kitaev chain actually generates this. So that was understood back in 2010. And as an example, within the example, there's a case of 2 Kitaev chains on top of another. Right, so every fermion and 2 Majorana modes were coupled like this. Good, so now we have 2 Majorana modes living on the edge. And again, these turn out to be protected. But this time around, it turns out they're protected by time reversal symmetry, complex conjugation in this case. So by protecting again, I just mean that the symmetry fractionalizes non-trivially on the edge. In this case, it protects it gives a Kramer's degeneracy on the edge. So there's a fermionic mode there. OK, so now, yes?
Is there a classification of this approach in Kitaev? Is it for free theories?
No, so this is interacting. It's very interacting. This is the general. Okay, exactly.
So it's bosonic and fermionic interacting.
So it makes sense to, basically, the idea was, yeah, it's once you have the fermions, you have the boson. The fermion's kind of harder example of bosons, so. Yeah, welcome. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. I guess, this is a general classification. We don't presume non-interacting. If you presume non-interacting, the Z8 becomes Z. You get an infinite number of chains. But that's maybe we shouldn't go into that here. Good. So now I can formulate claim 1. 2 times Kitaev, by which I mean what I just wrote down, stacking 2 Kitaevs, is Jordan-Wigner dual 2. The cluster model. Okay, so to see this, we would first like to, okay, fine, it's a well-defined system up there, this stack of Tukey type chains, but we would like a generally 1D system. Now it's kind of this fake 1D system, right? But it's actually very simple to kind of make it a 1D system by just putting this guy here, putting this guy here, and I'll just draw it. What I mean, so we have now so you see that I've just kind of pushed both of them into one line. And so you can see, again, we have two Majorana modes with the same system. But now, pictorially, it looks very similar to what I drew for the Kitaev chain right there, right? We just have one side further that our Majoranas are linked up. So it's actually, the Hamiltonian is exactly the same thing. So for Kitaev chain, we had plus one, but now it's plus two, because we have one side further, okay? And yeah, you can already maybe see on site, it's going to be really trivial calculation. Plugging in the Jordan-Wigner, it's exactly the same thing. Now, but just because everything is one side further, there's one Z that does not get canceled of the Jordan-Wigner string. And so we just get the same result as the Kitaev chain. Sorry, the Ising model, but now with an extra Z in the middle, which is exactly what the cluster model was defined to be up there. Good, so it's definitely not an advanced statement right here. It couldn't be more direct. But so the funny thing is, well, you would think then people already knew this, but I guess it's a bit subtle because people have definitely looked at the cluster model, and it's kind of 1D is kind of obvious to use Jordan-Wigner to exactly solve it. And so people had done Jordan-Wigner and sometimes even Majorana representation. And so it was there, but no one really bothered to kind of point it out. And the thing is, it's not just of a look, I can say this, so you should be interested. But the thing is, I think it always helps to make these things explicit, because now we see that we have a relationship between two SPTs, right? We have a fermionic SPT on the one hand and a spin SPT on the other hand. And let's now take this seriously. What is this telling us? Well, okay, we know this is a fermionic SPT with respect to time reversal symmetry, right? So there's a, this is protected by T. That's like the relevant one that makes this a well-defined topological phase. Whereas on the other hand, in our intro, we saw this one is protected by these P1 and P2 symmetries, which form the Z2 cross Z2 structure. So clearly, on a group theoretic level, they have nothing to do with each other. This is some anti-unitary symmetry. This is Z2 cross Z2. So if we take this seriously, then actually that suggests that there should be another symmetry in the cluster model that protects it. Namely, there should be some anti-unitary symmetry that corresponds to the symmetry. It's not just necessarily the Jordan-Wigner transformation, because as you pointed out, the Jordan-Wigner transformation can non-trivially change the physics. But still, there should be something like this. And indeed, it turns out if you just take P times T, P just being spin flips and complex conjugation, right? So P is just a product of P1 and P2, right? The definition of there, if you just have P1 and P2, you're doing Zs everywhere. So doing Zs everywhere and then doing complex conjugation turns out to also protect the topological phase. So now we have a new symmetry that protected, by which I mean, even if you break this symmetry, but preserve this one, the edge modes, topological phase, stay well defined. Okay, so that's interesting because to those familiar with some 1D stuff, and this might sound familiar, because now we have a Z2 cross Z2 structure and an anti-unitary symmetry protecting the phase. And so that calls for another very short intermezzo, namely in a 1D, there is the Haldane phase, which is a spin chain, which is also known to be a topological phase. And it's a, so it's a spin chain protected by two possible symmetries, actually more, but let's focus on two. On the other hand, on the one hand, we can have spin rotation symmetry, but we're going to focus on the discrete subgroup. So we do pi rotations around the x-axis, or pi rotations around the z-axis. So these together, again, form a z2 cross z2 structure, because that's one thing of spin ones, then these commute. Or alternatively, it's protected by time reversal symmetries acting on spins, which is defined by this guy. Okay, so the point here is that, look, okay, there's obviously the same algebra going on here. We have some anti-unitary symmetry, a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry protecting the topological face, which is exactly what we saw there. So that then, said it already on a general level, I always want to say, look, we have, in some sense, we can say the cluster model is in the Haldane phase. But let's be more exact, because we can get something more interesting out of it. Oh, what should I erase? Okay, so claim, I guess, 2. The following is that our cluster state. So now I say state, because for the moment I want to focus on the grand state. So if I say model, if I say the model, then I mean the Hamiltonian. If I say the state, I mean the grand state. The cluster state is, bear with me for a moment, the so-called fixed point limit of the AKLT state. Okay, so for a moment, forget about fixed point limit. And also, in this intermezzo, I should have pointed out what the AKLT state is. So, okay, I told you what the Haldane phase is. And there's a very well-known example of a system in the Haldane phase. It's namely the Heisenberg spin 1 anti-ferromagnet. Where should I stand? Okay, so it's just this guy for spin 1. So that's in the Haldane phase. But it turns out that in the 80s, Affleck, Kennedy, Leap, and Tazaki figured out that if you add a term that doesn't change the phase, then now this model becomes exactly soluble, and this is the so-called AKLT model, right? Okay, and so I'm basically saying, look, the cluster state is in some sense the AKLT state. So there's this here, which will come clear in a moment. But to even compare them, right? So as I said, okay, on a group theoretic level, they're very similar groups going on, but physically they're quite different, right? P1 and P2, they have this kind of very site-dependent effect, having to do with even odd sites, and they would somehow have to be related to some internal rotation symmetry. So before we can, well, let's adjust the following, right? That if we start with a cluster state, right, and we had our symmetries, somehow what we want to do is partition our system into unit cells like this, and do some kind of rotation within this unit cell, so that then in this new basis, these symmetries act like internal rotations. And so it turns out that indeed, there is a simple two-side transformation, so that again, we get a spin a half system, and we have unit cells. And then now, P1 acts like spin rotation around the x-axis, the pi rotation. Similarly for P2. Of course, we had also the other symmetry, right? Pt, which was z1, z2, z3, with a complex conjugation. That then corresponds to what we wanted to correspond to, namely time reversal symmetry for spins. So now we've rephrased our cluster model in a language where it's become sensible to compare it to these other phases that I just mentioned, like the AKLT state. Okay, and then it's not surprising that once you formulate into this, it turns out that their symmetry fractionization is actually the same as in the Haldane phase. That is, you can really say, look, it's in the Haldane phase, it has defined by the same projective representations. But we can go further here. And okay, we wonder now, okay, what happens on the level of the Hamiltonian, right? We had a very concrete Hamiltonian here, right? This three-site spin interaction. And it turns out that then in this, if you just do this two-sided channel basis, they kind of decouple in the sense that they only act on regions like this, where it basically, hope you can read it in the back. So where we now have these kind of simple interactions that don't overlap, to just write down the Hamiltonian, where we sum over the bonds. By bonds, I mean the spaces in between these unit cells, and where we have this kind of interaction, you know, x working on this spin, this x working on that spin. Okay, so that's a bit of a funny looking Hamiltonian. If there were this guy there, right, that would be more familiar. Then we know, oh, okay, this is just some kind of anti-fermionic coupling between these two spins. And then we know that in the ground state, we expect the spin a half to form a spin singlet. That's the lowest energy state, right? But actually, it turns out that, okay, this guy is obviously not there, but it doesn't affect the ground state. It's not too hard to see. And okay, then we have the ground state now, where we have these spin singlets kind of sewn together. And on the edges, we have these free spin a halves sitting there, which is exactly the physics of the Haldane phase. Right, and in particular, this is not just Haldane phase, this ground state is known as the ground state of the AKLT state, with a small caveat there, because as I said, the AKLT state is a spin one system, right, this Heisenberg thing, and then we're talking about spin a half systems. And on first sight, that might seem like an important difference, but actually it turns out in this case, it's not. If you would put spin one projectors on these unit cells, then you would make into a physical spin one system, and you would get the AKLT state. And it turns out if you start with that state, and you start doing RG, you kind of zoom out, box spins, zoom out, you then approach a fixed point limit, which is exactly this thing without the spin one projectors, which is exactly the state I wrote down. So that's called the fixed point limit of the AKLT state. So that's why there was this caveat there. But yeah, on first level, you can think of the cluster state as basically being the AKLT state, which is kind of funny because also the cluster model and the AKLT model are both, in a way, standard models of topological phase in 1D. And this now reminds me of a quote. I don't know if you know John McGreevy, but has these like excellent lecture notes on QFT. And somewhere he's talking about dualities. And then he makes this point that's he warrants possibly the pressing comment. And he says, you know, sometimes you can start to realize that these dualities are a bit of a depressing realization, because we thought we could solve two systems, but then we realize they're actually the same system, so we can only solve one. So it's something similar here. But still, nonetheless, we can get some new insights from this. For example, one thing you can note is that this clearly has a full SO3 symmetry, because it has like spin singlets. So that means that the ground state of the cluster state also has a full SO3 symmetry, which is quite surprising. If you just look at the definition, this looks like a very discrete definition. And then that raises the question, is that an important fact? Because, for example, the ground state of this is known to be relevant for measurement-based quantum computing. And that's the first reason it came up. And the question is that related to the fact that we have these nice symmetries in the ground state, et cetera? Other questions you can ask, to what extent are relationships between the AKLT, which generalizes to higher dimensions? Is there also a relationship with the cluster state, which also generalizes to higher dimensions, et cetera? So there's probably no easy answer to these questions, but there's a few questions that it raises. So there's a few other claims that I won't go into now, because I mean, I don't want to overload as well. And there's something I find a bit more fun to talk about as well in the last few minutes. But first, let me write down two other claims just for those in the know that they know, I guess. So you can zoom, tune out for half a minute. So basically, one claim you can make is that, for example, if you, again, take this stack of 2K tie-off chains, turns out to be the same as the so-called Su-Schiffer-Hager model. And using this, you can also, if you look at the stack of 4K tie-off chains, which is where interactions play an important role. So far, we haven't had to worry about interactions, but in this case, interactions are crucial. Then it turns out you can rewrite this as a Hubbert model, or more exactly, a Hubbert ladder. Right, with some kind of on-site electron interaction. And in particular, if you take the Mott limit, it becomes a spin half system, and we again get the AKLT state out of this. So now we see that we can relate key type chain to AKLT state without Jordan-Wigner transformation in a more, perhaps more physical way, right? Okay, but then I have about 5 minutes, I guess, left to. Should I do this? So okay, the last part, I just want to discuss a general issue, right? If I give you two phases of matter, right, and I give you how to understand them, right, some order parameter or something, you can think of these projective representations as mathematical order parameters or something. If I give you that information, can you predict what is the phase transition between them? Right, so I suppose SPTA, SPTB, and so this is now parameter space. So all these points are SPTA, SPTA. And so somewhere in parameter space, there'll be a phase transition line. And so I'm asking, okay, I have some kind of line from one to the other. Can we predict what to expect there? Okay, so it's a fairly simple question to ask. Okay, so first, quite a nice thing again about this topological phases. So one nice property is that, remember this group structure, right? If I have two SPTs, I can stack them, right? There's a group relation. In particular, any SPT has an inverse, meaning there is so-called a minus SPTB, so that if I stack it onto SPTB, I get a trivial phase. So let's stack minus SPTB everywhere along this line. So I don't change that along the line. Everywhere along this line, add minus SPTB, minus SPTB. Okay? Then this guy, by definition, becomes a trivial phase. This guy just becomes some other state, some SPT. And then this region here, that actually doesn't change at all, because we had a critical theory, gapless theory, and we added some gapped chain. The low energy theory doesn't change. So actually, it's effectively doing nothing at all. So the point here is that this easily allows us to reduce the question to asking, if I have an SPT and a trivial phase in parameter space, can I predict what the phase transition will be? I note that this argument should extend to any dimension, as far as I can see. So that's just kind of a neat property of topological phases. Good. Good. Then there's an intuition of what to expect for these phases. Because if you start in a topological phase and you go to the trivial phase, then there's one way the system thinks of doing this. Because remember that as long as left and right are not overlapping, the state remains well defined, right? So we have our, to the intuition here. So we have our 1D system. Basically, for these two guys, for this system to become trivial, they kind of have to connect together and gap out, and the system is trivial. So the system wants to like extend these modes until eventually they overlap, and then the system can become trivial. But these modes were localized up to the correlation length, right? So that means indeed that we want, for the phase transition, we expect the correlation length to go to infinity, which is exactly a second order transition. But we could actually expect more. Again, writing our system, thinking now even in a more stick figure way, this guy wants to get to this other side and meet his friend to gap out, right? So basically, at the phase transition, this guy travels through the bulk to the other end. So that suggests that whatever the critical theory is, it's basically whatever was living on the boundary, but promoted one dimension up, right? So
are you talking about phase transitions as parameter space, change parameters on the model?
So I suppose we have some literal Hamiltonian, and I know in one limit it's some SPT, in the other limit it's a trivial phase, and so I have some tuning of the Hamiltonian, some parameter, yeah, and then exactly what critical point is there between them. And so, for example, if there was a Majorana mode living here, some 0 plus 1D Majorana, then I would, you know, with this picture, would intuitively expect that you just get the 1 plus 1 dimensional version of like a gapless Majorana traveling through the bulk, which is exactly the universality class of the Ising transition. So that's the right result. But OK, that's just an intuitive picture, right? So I can't give you a general proof. I mean, even if not just because I don't have the time, but also just because I don't know. But what I can tell you is a particular result, basically saying that there is a path from SPT to trivial, let's call it alpha, right? Let's call it alpha, such that the critical point is determined by the edge mode in the gapped phase in exactly this fashion that you just kind of, you know, promoted one dimension up. And in particular, it's not fine-tuned, right? Because you wouldn't be interested in just like a very fine-tuned example, which is not generic. By which this I mean that the conformal, so okay, by doing this, you kind of typically get a conformal field theory by just writing down these operators, you know, writing an action with these operators that you had living on the edge. And then this statement comes down to the CFT has no relevant perturbations allowed by symmetry, right? So that means it's not fine-tuned, it's stable. So that then the result is that you get that there's some, okay, the first part shows that this point, there's at least one point where this intuitive argument goes through, and then the second point means, okay, there's some finite extension when this argument goes through. And then for me at least, together with intuition, I think it's quite plausible that that is the generic phase transition, but I think it would be very interesting if someone could actually find a counterexample to that. But yeah, it seems quite unlikely that that exists, but that would be very interesting. Yeah, so I don't really have the time to, the argument is really simple. But yeah, I guess it would take me a few more minutes, so I guess I'll stop here. So yeah, thank you for your attention. Yes.
Maybe you can elaborate a little bit.
What does this mean? Yeah, the basic idea would be that if you have your 1D phase, right, and we had our edge mode here, so they had some well-defined Hilbert space on the edge, right, some Majorana mode, some spin half, whatever it can be, and so now we just have this well-defined Hilbert space, and we put many copies in the line. Now we have a well-defined one-dimensional Hilbert space. And now on this, we can define several Hamiltonians. One Hamiltonian we can define is basically where you link up these guys like this. Think of like spin halves. And now I've linked them up into spin singlets. Oh, I missed one. Sorry, was not the most didactic mistake. So an even number. So if I have spin halves and I put them all into singlets, there's no edge modes, it's trivial. But I could have linked them up differently. So I had my spin a half particles here, and I linked them up like within the AKLT state, right? And now these partners are paired up, then we see we have spin a halves living on the edges. And now there's an obvious way to interpolate between them by kind of varying the relative hopping strength, right? And now we tune, that's to define the specific path between SPT to trivial. And then particularly at the phase transition, it'll be the one where the hopping is, you know, it's kind of a uniform hopping. And if you write such a kind of lattice Hamiltonian, you almost see on sight that the continuum limit is exactly something like this, like where you just basically, you know, replace the hopping by this. I see your frown. So how shall I say?
In general, there's some. I guess for spins, one gets okay. Spin one Heisenberg model, but you know, the fact that that has a conformal field theory description is quite non-trivial.
Right. So I guess. Well, think of, I think it's, for me it's easier to think in, I mean, in fermionic language. So let's suppose we have Jordan Winger transformed everything to the fermionic case. So we just have some kind of fermionic hopping model. And then I think it's quite clear that if you want to have a fermionic hopping model with uniform hopping, your field theory is just this kind of 1+1 dimensional version of whatever you had. So if you had Majorana modes, you have a field. And
I was saying that we need necessarily to go to the continuum limit to realize the transition.
No. I do the continuum limit to see what field theory describes it. So the transition is there even at the lattice case. You know, you need a thermodynamic limit for that, but no, it's just because then to talk about a CFT at all, I need to do a continuum limit.
Yeah, I think what Max mentioned, I think for this AKLT model, the transition is SU2 level 1 WCW model, so it's a contact example. If we presume SU2 symmetry,
So that's why is that a conflict then?
Suppose you start from the Hotend chain.
Right.
You have this AQT model. You have si.s plus beta si.s j square.
Yeah.
And suppose you tune this beta, you realize the transition. So my claim is that the transition from trivial to non-trivial is PT phase. It's SC2 level 1 WZ double mod.
So which is central charge?
Central charge 1. It's not free fermion. It's some indirect mod.
Well,
I think it's important to specify the global symmetry. So in this sense, this class model and the AQT model, they are not equivalent because in one model, you have this Z2 cross Z2 symmetry, but in the other model, usually we think about it, it's a SO3 spin rotational symmetry.
Wait, right.
If you preserve.
Well, so you can definitely write down a trace transition from the Haldane phase to trivial, which satisfies this. So you're saying it doesn't describe every possible phase transition.
No, in the class model, I think it's a free fermion because you can just add some sigma z term and you tune the coefficients and you can map to some x y model as a free fermion condition. But on the other hand, if you preserve the SU2 symmetry, I think it's different problem, different universality class.
Okay.
Exactly.
No, I see what you mean. Okay,
if you talk about the transition preserve z2 cross z2 symmetry. It's
right.
A different result.
Right.
You think about it.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about the symmetry, the bare symmetry you need to have the well-defined edge modes. So you're saying if you have an extra full
I'm just talking about when you think about this SPT phase, usually you need to claim what's a global symmetry. If you claim it's a SU2 symmetry, then it's different from the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry. Although the wave function can look like the same, just some decoupled diamond, but the important thing is that what's a global symmetry dimension.
Right. But from an SPT point of view, then that's an additional symmetry. You didn't explicitly need to have that phase, right?
I don't want to claim in that way.
Okay.
Because if you look at the wave function, you know, whatever symmetry you want to claim, it's as long as the project representation is two dimensions, just the same wave function. But then the details is how you implement your global symmetry.
No, isn't that, wait, aren't you saying?
Will dramatically change your universality class when phase transition because you constrain all these random operators. Yeah. So that's why you make the difference. So my counterexample is that in the AQLT model, you tune this beta, you realize the transition as SU2 level 1 WCW model. If you preserve SU2.
Yeah, but then you are adding extra constraints.
That's not the extra constraint.
Well, I mean, as in.
That's the usual definition for AQLT model, usually where it's
okay.
Stable. That's the
no, way. No, I got it. That's a very fair comment.
I think the issue is that if your symmetry group is somehow non trivial, so that you cannot map the free fermions, then you maybe don't know what the CFT is. If you can map the free fermions, that's, yeah, obviously. What
you're saying is, yeah, if you think about the abelian symmetry group, I guess it's true. You can if you suppose you have SPT protected by abelian symmetry group, then you can map everything returned. That might be true. But it's, yeah, if you think about SPT of like AC2 symmetry, that's a non-trivial counterexample.
Okay, yeah.
Just with your construction. Mm-hmm. And so you have some projected representations of some mm-hmm. maybe non-trivial, maybe non-abelian symmetry G. Suppose the symmetry was from Z2 cross Z2, but
mm-hmm.
some complicated. And you have each one on each side.
Yeah.
And you do this tuning to a point where the coupling, I mean, first of all, you have to discuss okay, how are they coupled. Right now you have some.
But in the fermionic case, we know what we.
In the fermionic case,
yeah, so I was
stuck with it. But in some general case of some.
Well, you can always draw a Wigner, so you think of cases where you cannot. I guess I was intuitively thinking of cases where you can draw a Wigner map. Let me just.
Yeah,
talk.
But it's the interacting fermion, it's not free.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, but no, okay, I get what you mean. But you don't. No, even with interacting fermions, that's fine. Because even, for example, this argument goes through for example, the case with four Kitaev chains, which is known to need interactions to be well defined. So it's because. It's a bit subtle, I guess, because you can start with non interacting fermions. And you can add interactions and have a certain SPT phase. But then once you have that SPT phase, then you have certain well-defined edge modes. And I'm then taking as my fundamental units those edge modes. So even when interacting from fermionic system, you can have a certain edge mode, but still that edge mode is some kind of Hilbert space. And it might transform differently than usually fermions transform under symmetries, but it's a well-defined.
Once you make a model out of that, you know, with equal couplings,
right?
What is? How do you know what the transition is? Some complicated model.
Well, no, because in that case, that's a bit. Yeah, maybe we can talk more on the blackboard. But yeah.
Yeah, I think that for the AQLT chain on this global SA2 symmetry, the situation if we map some fermion models, it looks like some massive fermion coupled to some nonlinear CM model. So if you integral up fermion, it will generate this SA2 level 1, W2, which makes the fixed transition non trivial, not just a free fermion.
I think it might be a good idea to respond to this discussion. Are there any other questions?
Okay, so I'm saying that the symmetry group is the same as in all these two phases.
Which two phases?
I'm saying that symmetry group is the same in these two phases.
Which two phases?
For example, A and B.
So they have to be the same physical symmetry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but not the same projective relativity.
Okay, let's thank Ruben again.